We turn in the Word of God to 2 Kings chapter 4. 2 Kings chapter 4. These chapters, chapters 4 through 7, set before us a range of tragedies and tragic circumstances. And they all involve Elisha. But Elisha is not the point of these situations. It is God who is the point. And that is what we are to constantly see. And immediately there is a lesson for us. How often we see the events, sometimes even the preacher. But do we see God? That's the thing. Do we learn to trust God even in the dark, even in the midst of tragedies? And that's what the writer keeps saying to us from one tragedy to another. He brings us to these desperate situations, one after the other, until we actually get the point. It's as if he's saying in each situation, what's your reaction? What's your response? What's your response in this situation and that situation? Did you see God there? Did you grasp what God did? Did you see his wonder and his marvel and the works that he wrought? Do you trust God in the worst situation? So our theme this morning is seeing God amidst tragedy. Seeing God amidst tragedy. First of all, in verses 1 to 7, God's help is sometimes hidden. God's help is sometimes hidden. Here is a woman, and her situation is drastic. Look at what we're told. Death, debt, and debtors. And it's been one tragedy after another. Her husband has died. Debt has piled up. And the debtors are on their way to the house. And she's about to lose, it seems, the only thing left. Her two sons. And it's in that situation that something remarkable happens. Elisha asks, well, what have you got in the house left? She says, nothing. Just a pot of oil. For Elisha, of course, what is left is not nothing. It's something. It's an opportunity. A possibility. A start. Then he said, verse 3, go borrow the vessels abroad of all thy neighbors, even empty vessels, borrow not a few. But notice the condition that is laid down. Verse 4, when thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee and upon thy sons. She sells the oil, of course, and pays the debt. What we see is how God multiplies what she has with the help of others. But God's help is hidden. That's the point. It is hidden behind closed doors, behind pots and neighbors and selling. That's what the writer wants us to see. You see, we live in a culture, at least amidst evangelicalism, where it seems unless you see a great miracle, God, as it were, does not seem to exist. God always has to be doing something outwardly spectacular. But Elijah is saying, God's help sometimes hidden. And it's hidden in strange places. behind closed doors, empty pots, neighbours, and selling. We look for a miracle. We don't see it, apparently, on the outside of the house. I've heard about the debt, and the debt, and the debtors, and we stand back to see a miracle. We don't see it, apparently. And yet God has done something, but he's hidden it from gaze, behind all the pots, and the neighbours, and the selling. Let us not conclude, because no one else sees and knows, that God is therefore absent, that God hasn't done anything extraordinarily, anything spectacular. And yet he has acted wonderfully, hasn't he? He's acted wonderfully behind the borrowing and the neighbours and the selling. God has helped. God has worked in the midst of the ordinary. That's the wonderful thing. It's an astonishing thing. The famous John Witherspoon was one day in a study. There's a man came running to the house, banging on the door, got into the study. "Mr. Witherspoon," he said, "let us rejoice. God has done something wonderful." "What has he done?" "Well, I was riding with my horse and cart over a dangerous part of the mountain. And whatever happened, the cart broke free and the horse ran off and the cart tipped over, but I survived." Witherspoon replied, "Here is something more remarkable. I have travelled that way hundreds of times. The horse was never startled, never broke free, the cart never overturned. Isn't that extraordinary? It's in the ordinary that God works, often hidden from view. But you see, in our naivety, in our clumsiness, and in our stupidity, we're always looking for a sign, something marvelous. Well, here is something absolutely astonishing and supernatural. But it's behind closed doors, behind the pots and the neighbours and the selling. In other words, often God keeps his help hidden. Secondly, God's goodness is sometimes puzzling. Verses 8 through 37. Here is a long narrative. It seems convoluted. Much of it seems unnecessary. And yet every single verse is crucial to building a specific picture for us. It begins with a lady who shows kindness in verses 8 to 11. We learn that she doesn't need anything in verse 13. Elisha suggests, "Is there something you want? Would you like me to go and speak to the king for you?" "No." "Maybe you'd like me to go and speak to the captain of the host?" "No. I dwell amongst my own people. I have everything I want. I don't need anything. I don't want anything. I am a contented person." So she doesn't need anything. She doesn't ask for anything. What can you give someone who doesn't want anything? He doesn't need anything. And yet, she is given one thing she doesn't even look for, doesn't ask for. In verses 14 to 17, she is given a son. She didn't ask for a child. She isn't looking for a child. And yet God gives her a child. How extraordinary. God
shall we say, makes her happy.
Even though she has everything and doesn't want anything. And then tragedy comes. Verses 18 to 20. The child dies. But that isn't the end of the narrative. She gets ready for a journey. Her husband is puzzled. She doesn't explain anything to him. Everything's fine, she says. All will be well. Well, everything's not well. Son has fallen ill. Son dies. She comes to Elisha face to face. Verse 28. Then she said, did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Elisha notes that her soul is vexed within her. So she comes and there is demand, and there is puzzlement, and there is anguish, and there is turmoil, and there is questioning. God's goodness has turned into tragedy. How are we to understand this? She didn't even want anything. But God has given her something. And the whole thing has become a matter of anguish and pain and suffering. God's goodness has turned into tragedy. God's goodness had made her happy. But now it is all turned to vexation. How could this be? Why? Why her? Why this? Why now? Why this way? We have a lot of those questions, don't we? Why? Seems as if God has done something bad. He's made his goodness bad. And her soul is vexed. She's in pain. She's in anguish. She hurts. It all hurts. Why? But there's something even worse. Verse 27. Elisha has no answer. He has no answer as to why all this has happened. The Lord hath hid it from me, hath not told me. He doesn't have an answer for her. And sometimes that's the way it is. We don't have any specific reason. Oh, we have a general reason often. For the glory of God is often a sufficient reason. For our own good is often a sufficient reason. But sometimes there's no specific reason. We can't give a precise answer to a particular person about a particular issue. And we have to live with that sometimes. Oh, in due time we shall know. But sometimes we don't know. We can't explain why God's goodness is turned into tragedy. That's what this section is telling us. Sometimes God's goodness can be puzzling. Oh, we can rattle off cliches. And we evangelicals can be very good at cliches. We're very good at giving someone a slap on the back and say, oh, I'm all right, friend. You know, the Lord will take care of you, and so on and so on. And that's it. And we think that that's fine. But the one who's hurting and suffering, they don't want cliches. They want honesty and frankness. God's goodness can be puzzling. He seems good one moment. And then the goodness is turned upside down. And the whole world is in turmoil. And we're just aching with pain and anguish and hurt. Thirdly, God's triumph is something to remember. Verses 38 to 41. We've noted thus far, verses 1 to 7, death and debt. In verses 8 to 37, goodness turns to death. In verses 38 to 41, there is both dearth and death. Here's another tragic circumstance. Dearth. That word dearth is translated elsewhere in our Bibles as hunger and famine. And it raises the question, why was there a famine in this land at all? Well, we've referred to this passage on previous occasions. We must refer to it again. Leviticus 26 and verse 20, "And your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits." Verse 26, "And when I have broken the staff of your bread, 10 women shall bake your bread in one oven, and they shall deliver you your bread again by weight, and ye shall eat and not be satisfied." And then if we turn to the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 28 and verse 38, "Thou shalt carry much seed out into the field, and shalt gather but little in, for the locusts shall consume it. Thou shalt plant vineyards and dress them, but shalt neither drink of the wine nor gather the grapes, for the worms shall eat them. Thou shalt have olive trees throughout all thy coast, but thou shalt not anoint thyself with the oil, for thine olive shall cast its fruit." What we have here is a covenant dearth. A covenant dearth. A dearth sent by God, consistent with his covenant. And note also, the sons of the prophets, who represent the church and the nation, the believing remnant, they are suffering in the famine. Just because of their position doesn't mean they shall escape. And there is nothing more basic than food, daily bread. It's the one thing Christ taught us to pray for. Give us this day our daily bread. There is nothing more basic than that. And yet even that had turned into death, verse 39 and 40. Here is this pot of pottage. It's now been filled with a poisonous herb of some sort, wild vine, wild gourds. They poured out for the men to eat, and there was death in the pot. So they aren't just suffering the dearth in the land, but the little that they have has turned to death. It will kill them. Verse 41 is a work of necessity. "But he said, then bring meal. And he cast it into the pot, and he said, pour out for the people that they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot." Here's a miracle of necessity, but a miracle in a pot with meal. God kept his promise of daily bread, of sustenance. And that is what we are to remember. It is he who feeds us. keeps us, sustains us. In other words, if God were to break the staff of bread, no matter how much we would eat, we would still die. God could take away the sustenance of it, and we couldn't survive. And that's what this passage is telling us. God's triumph. That's something to remember. In the bare necessities of life, in the basics, God keeps and sustains. The reason you are alive today is because God kept you. He has kept you through dearth and famine and war and all kinds of things. God has kept you. And fourthly, verses 42 to 4. God's provision is sometimes remarkable. Here's a man, and he brought 20 loaves from Elisha. But his postal address is most striking. He comes from an extraordinary place. His home address is not one that tells us there's anybody who would be sympathetic to Elisha. Baal, referring to this false god, is Elisha. And yet, from that place comes what? Fruit, bread, and corn. God gives from the most unlikely source. Baal Shalisha, the giver, is commanded, feed all these people, 100 sons of the prophets. Give it to them. The giver is shocked. You want to give this to them? We can almost hear him saying, you must be joking. There isn't enough here to feed all those mouths. This is a dearth, so they're hungry. You think this will keep them? I brought it for you. It would keep you. But Elisha is unmoved. Yes, he said, give it to them. And then he says in verse 43, for thus saith the Lord, they shall eat and shall leave thereof. You know what's going to happen? They're going to eat all this fruit and corn and these 20 loaves, and there'll be food left over. How remarkable. And in verse 44, so he set it before them, and they did eat, and left thereof, according to the word of the Lord. Deuteronomy chapter 8, and verses 2 to 4. Thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble thee, and to prove thee, and to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no. And he humbled thee, and suffered thee to hunger, and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. Thy raiment waxed not old upon thee, neither did thy foot swell these 40 years. So here we have this amazing provision from a most unlikely source, Baal Shalisha. And what happens? They're all fed, and there's plenty left over. What is Elisha's point? Elisha's point is that God gives and God keeps. It is God who supplies from unusual backgrounds and contacts. That's what is remarkable. Chapter 4 is saying to you and I, do you see how God works in each tragedy? It is God who is present all the time. It is God who is working all the time. That's what we are to notice. This brings me to application. First of all, seeing God in the ordinary. Notice how commonplace everything is in chapter 4. Death, dearth, death. I suppose we might say it's what life consists of often. This history says this is where God is. This is where God works. He works in the midst of death. He works in the midst of death. He works in the midst of dearth. God is present in all of these things. And that is why all this detail is given to us. Let us not get the notion that God only works in extraordinary situations. He's always in the ordinary. Instead of looking for the extraordinary and the usual and the miraculous, it's all here in the ordinary. John Bunyan, in his preface to Grace Abounding, he writes this: have you forgot the milk house, the stable, the barn, and the like, where God did visit your soul? Isn't that wonderful? Oh, we know he's using these agricultural illustrations. That's his background. But in the milk house, have you forgotten? God visited your soul and did you good. Richard Baxter wrote, canst not thou think on the several places thou hast lived in, and remember that they each have had their several mercies? Think of the various places, the various houses you've lived in. Can you not say Baxter, they've each had their several mercies? Walter Pringle, a Puritan, he told his children on one occasion the exact places in which certain things happened to him. His first experience of prayer came, he said, at the northeast of Stitchell Hall. Years later, he committed his newly born son to God at the plum tree on the north side of the garden door. In the ordinary things, seeing God, every time you go out that back door into the garden, see the plum tree. That's where I gave my son to God. Or the northeast of Stitchell Hall. I don't know what part of the hall that was, apart from the northeast. But there's a seat there, he was saying, in Stitchell Hall. That's where I first prayed. Seeing God in the ordinary. That's what chapter 4 is saying. In yonder house, where there was death and death, God used a pile of pots borrowed from neighbours. And he brought relief. In another house, belonging to a Shunammite, God's goodness and tragedy went together. In Gilgal, there was a pot there. Death was turned into life. An amazing provision. By a man from Baal Shalisha. God was in all of those things. Those little things that happened along the way. Christ is saying to us, God was there, and there, and there, every occasion. You know, that's what we should do, shouldn't we? There's a wonderful exercise for this afternoon. Think of all the times and places and circumstances God did your soul good. A place, an event, tragedy. God did good to your soul. Or something you may, like Walter Pringle, may have done that blessed your soul. Sometimes we are blind to the ordinary. We just can't see God in the ordinary. But we should. That's what chapter 4 is saying over and over. Seeing God in the ordinary. Then secondly, the prophetic significance of God's dealings. Notice the lad who sneezed 7 times. What did it signify? A sign of life. What's it doing? It's pointing us forward, is it not? To when all the dead in Christ shall be raised to life. What's this event telling us? God alone delivers us from death. But he will deliver all his people from death. But there's something else fascinating about this event. It's the place. Shunem. Shunem was on the south of the hill of Moreh. Now, why on earth should that matter? Because in Luke 7, you have a similar event. Luke 7, verses 11 to 17. And here's a funeral procession. Dead man carried out the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And much people of the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and said unto her, weep not. And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said, young man, I say unto thee, arise. Where did this happen? It happened at Nain. Nain is on the north side of the hill of Moreh. I'm sure those people could make that connection that we're making. On the north side, they see a miracle. On the south side, another young son had been raised alive. The point is, God raises the dead. It's true in the Old Testament. It's true in the New Testament. God raises the dead. But there's another prophetic thing, surely. It's the feeding of the 100. And again, don't you see the New Testament parallel in Mark 6, verses 30 to 44, the feeding of the 5,000. In Mark 8, verses 1 to 10, the feeding of the 4,000. And when you turn to John 6, verse 9, you have the same question. There's a lad here which had 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. But what are they among so many? It's the same point of 2 Kings 4, verse 43. What should I set this before 100 men? It's so little. Are you sure this can feed so many? It's the same in John 6. So little for so many. And you have the same result. The baskets left over in 2 Kings 4. The baskets left over in Mark 6, 43. And Mark 8, verse 8. Mark is saying, God is still the same. Mark in 2 Kings chapter 4 agree. They're both saying, God is a supernatural God. He's amazing. He's astonishing. God can do these things. He's an unchanging God. He takes so little. And yet he can do so much with so little. We think when we need to do something, we need at least a start with £1 million and 1,000 people, unless we're going to achieve anything. But when God does anything, he starts with so little. In the most unusual of places, with the most unattractive of people. Yet he does these big things. Friends, this is the God who saved us. This is the God who promises to keep us. And he will look after us. Can we not trust him to keep us? Can we not believe him? Even in the ordinary. And finally, sometimes we just have to walk by faith when God's way is in the dark. That Shunammite, she just had to submit to God's providence and just walk by faith. But there is a statement in John 13 that ought to be precious to us. Jesus answered and said unto him, "What I do, thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter." John 13, verse 7. In other words, God's providences are sometimes in the dark. They are dark providences, but they shall be made clear. Elisha, he had no long, clear explanation. God did it. She will just have to walk by faith. She will just have to wait on God's providence. She trusts the man of God. She trusts Elisha. But Elisha's saying to her, you just have to trust God. And that's the way it is, isn't it? There are dark providences. But they will be made clear in due time. In the meantime, friends, walk by faith and not by sight. Amen.